Hey guys, Carmen and Ian here again. Hello, Ian. We are back with more Stacio stuff for you. We are specifically working on some resources for 2024, and one of them is going to center around the reasons why Ian and I think we're in such like a cultural mess, but not just why, we're also going to talk about practical solutions for getting out of it, because we think that Christians have the arguments and the resources to move us forward. So one of the problems that we have pinpointed that we're going to spend some time talking about here and then also in some articles on Stacios is the influence of the Enlightenment, which I'm excited to learn from Ian. Ian's a history savant, is that the right word? Phenom, brilliant mind.
I don't know if savant's exactly positive, but
oh, it's not.
I won't speak in my own defense.
Let's see. Let me look up what savant means. Someone said it to me recently.
Has some negative connotations.
It does.
I suppose I could be accused of being a history savant.
Does savant mean you think you're really smart, but you're not?
I mean, it's more like you're incredibly knowledgeable about a subject, but you're like blinkered and autistic, basically.
That's not what I meant. No, Ian's not a savant.
I didn't think that's what you were saying, but some people may have interpreted your comment.
That is really funny because the person that used savant when I was talking to them definitely thought it was positive. That's why I said it about you, but we're all just spreading now. He and I are out there making it positive on accident. Whoops.
That's it.
No, a history expert should have just gone with a normal word. It's always safer.
Nice.
So Ian, tell me about the Enlightenment. Let's just start at the beginning. When is it? When do we place the Enlightenment in history? Because undoubtedly lots of people who are listening already know about it. But some people, that's going to be, they know about it, but they don't realize that they know about it, if that makes sense. So let's place it and describe it.
Yeah, so the Enlightenment, it can be used in multiple broad senses, but I think for our purposes, for this podcast and the way we use Enlightenment on Stacios when we refer to Enlightenment assumptions that people in the West have or that Christians have, we're talking about the Enlightenment as a period of thought, especially thought about philosophy, culture, and politics from the late 17th century to 1800, give or take a few years. And okay, the most significant figure associated with the Enlightenment is the French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Now that's a controversial statement to make because some people see Rousseau as a counter-Enlightenment figure, but for sure what is uncontroversial is the crowning political event of the Enlightenment was the so-called French Revolution and then the reign in France of the Jacobins, this militantly progressive atheistic regime who were for sure very inspired by the ideas of Rousseau. And that happened in the late 18th century.
Okay, yes. So essentially, we could boil it down to French Revolution, thinkers spawning out of that and subsequent events of the French Revolution kind of are the core of the Enlightenment, the beginning of the Enlightenment.
Yeah, I think anything that's leading up to or a few degrees removed from the French Revolution, that's a very rough way to refer to the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. but you are kind of capturing the essence of what the Enlightenment is if you talk about it in that way.
The spirit of it, yeah. And just a quick little plug here for a book that actually can give you a pretty good quick education on some things pertaining to the Enlightenment. This book by Andrew Clavin is so good. It's called The Truth and Beauty, and it's about it's primarily about the romantic poets of England, but they're coming off of the events of the French Revolution. And he actually talks quite a bit about Rousseau and just different things. So I was reviewing this in preparation for our conversation, and I realized so much of it is relevant to what we're talking about.
Yeah, fantastic book. I learned so much about the Romantics from this book as literary, you know, figures and poets, and I did not know a whole lot about the Romantics. And Clavin really posits that the Romantics are fundamentally people who came up in the Enlightenment, who in their youth were inspired by the French Revolution and then became disillusioned with it and had a sort of reactionary turn and reacted against the assumptions of the Enlightenment.
Right. Yeah, it's really very good. I would say if you're interested in what Ian and I are talking about today, this book itself would be a great resource and just fun to read. You learn a lot about poetry and history, but also he starts like talking about his interpretations of the Gospels at the end. It's a very interesting book. But back to the topic at hand. So that's sort of when the Enlightenment happened, sort of the major players. How do you see that as a problem? How is the Enlightenment? Obviously, lots of bad things happened during the French Revolution. It was a barbaric period of bloodshed. But, you know, obviously that was a long time ago. So why are we talking about the Enlightenment today as a negative influence on culture?
Because so many assumptions that are sort of uncritically taken as starting points by people in the West, and also unfortunately people in the church, are assumptions that originated with the Enlightenment. So just our way of speaking in secular modernity about religion as backwards, for example, associated with the past, archaic, and even Christians often speak in this way. And freeing ourselves from religion is associated with the future, with progress, man taking control of his own destiny, unshackling himself from superstition. Not only are these hallmarks of what secular modernity is, but even many Christians kind of unconsciously accept these sorts of assumptions in the way that they think and speak about history, about the Middle Ages, about, say, other religious groups today. Christians might kind of more or less portray themselves as superior on account of being more secular than other religious groups who are more sort of backwards and stuck in the past. I mean, that's a very Enlightenment way of thinking. Those are Enlightenment assumptions, and that's Enlightenment language. And no Christian before the Enlightenment would have thought or spoken in those terms. So it's important for us to talk about the Enlightenment so we can actually identify those assumptions that people are just uncritically accepting and then question them and ask why we hold those assumptions.
Right, because what a lot of people, I don't even think a lot of modern people even realize or even, they don't think or believe or realize that before the Enlightenment, progress was happening, you know, learning, education, advancement, all of these things were taking place prior to the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment essentially is like a very successful propaganda campaign to convince its adherents that, you know, before this line of thinking, this secularism, materialism, humanism, divorcing oneself from, you know, terrible traditions of the past, that like there was nothing good happening before that point. And anyone who knows even just a little bit of history knows that that wasn't the case. You know, you make many good arguments about the sort of mischaracterization of the Middle Ages, you know, preceding the Enlightenment, the way that Christians thought about themselves and the world and were the leaders of intellectual activity prior to the Enlightenment. So I think, like you're saying, it's just kind of uncritically assumed that this point in history is when we all really started to get concerned with progress and freedom and advancement when that wasn't the case.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the term Dark Ages, used by some people in modernity to refer to the entire Middle Ages, not used, by the way, today by really any serious historians, including secular historians. No serious secular historian today will use, quote unquote, the Dark Ages to refer to the entire Middle Ages. If you see anyone doing that, you know they're getting their kind of views about history from Reddit and they have no idea what they're talking about. But that term, the Dark Ages, comes from the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment is contrasting itself with the, quote unquote, darkness that allegedly came before it. by which it really means Christianity and Christian civilization. And usually, as you said, the implication is supposed to be that Christian civilization, that during the Middle Ages, when Christians and the institutional church enjoyed a geopolitical dominance throughout Europe and the West, that learning somehow was not valued. And in fact, the idea of the university goes back to the Carolingian Renaissance in the Low Middle Ages. Universities came out of cathedral schools. Cathedrals themselves are a result of the High Middle Ages and are pre-Enlightenment, pre-Renaissance even. They came from Christianity's admiration for beauty, its appreciation of mathematics, and the value that it placed on learning. And they stand today as this visible sign of the value that Christians place in kind of discovering all aspects of God's truth, and have always placed on discovering all aspects of God's truth prior to the so-called Enlightenment, which claimed to kind of rediscover the value of learning. I'll just say, you know, Christians will often say that the Enlightenment has sort of plagiarized from Christianity, and I have a somewhat different take on that. I tend to think, especially of Jacobinism and of the French Revolution as a pure inversion of Christianity. I don't think that they took Christian values and kind of mutated or extended them. I think they just reversed them entirely, and that's probably a subject for a whole other podcast episode. But I mean, just to jump off your point briefly about the Enlightenment creating a less just world, I mean, the one thing we can point to just offhandedly to demonstrate that is there were no totalitarian governments in medieval Europe. There was nothing like modern totalitarianism. There were no states micromanaging all aspects of people's lives, committing systematic genocide. States were relatively very limited. Power was divided between different spheres of life, different centers of regional power. And what happens when the Enlightenment occurs? The first time that the disciples of the Enlightenment control a government in Jacobin France, they massacre people in the streets of Paris, they drown monks and nuns in the Loire, they commit the first genocide in modern history in the Vendée. And, you know, there was no Stalin, there was no Hitler of the Middle Ages. These centralized kind of God surrogate omnipotent states are completely products of the Enlightenment. And if Christianity was even capable of creating something like that, it had 1,000 years in Europe in the Middle Ages to do it. And it never did, but the Enlightenment did it immediately as soon as it had power.
Right. That is a very interesting point. Would you say that most of these radical types, particularly Enlightenment types, right? What were they obsessed with? They were obsessed with the notion of freedom and the notion of equality. And do you think without the influence of Christianity, that could have, those two things would have come to be valued at such a high level? Obviously they took it, I mean, they take equality and freedom and want it divorced from any kind of objective morality or godlike authority. They want it, you know, purely situated in the individual. They say the individual, but ultimately that looks like a tyrannical government. Do you think they would have come to value equality and freedom so much without the influence of Christianity?
I think that you could maybe say the word equality has Christian origins, but I think that what Enlightenment thinkers are talking about when they speak about egalite or equality is fundamentally, qualitatively, a totally different and even opposite thing to the Christian conception of equal dignity and worth before God. I think that the Enlightenment, and especially Jacobin and then subsequently Marxist conception of morality, is fundamentally about uniformity, making all things flat, identical, making them mechanical, interchangeable parts, seeing any differences in roles between people or groups of people as suspect and things that should be dismantled. And I think that's not a mutation or an overapplication of Christianity. That's an inversion of what Christians have always believed. Christian, you know, metaphysics talks about the Trinity, and the church is one body composed of many parts that have different roles. The eye cannot say to the ear, I have no need of you. And the Enlightenment doesn't take that and kind of go astray with it. It just inverts it. And it places this emphasis on uniformity and sameness that I think is completely alien to the Christian tradition.
Gotcha. Yes, I know we were going to talk a little bit about the Enlightenment influence on egalitarianism that's widely just kind of absorbed in American culture. I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And it is obvious, like for Christians, I think it should be obvious that diversity is clearly God's preference, right? Like the entire arc of the Bible is God demonstrating that his preference is, sometimes maybe this is silly, but I just think about sort of, you know, the Great Commission is so astoundingly interesting. Like God wants, he's literally like, I need you to go get one of everybody. Like we can't leave out like one single group of people. And that in, you know, by itself is a very strong argument for something that is not uniform and homogeneous and a strong emphasis on diversity.
Well, if we're talking about areas where the Enlightenment has unconsciously influenced Christians, I think a major area we need to engage with is the Enlightenment idea that the state needs to be prioritized over all other spheres of society. And we need a state with massively centralized powers as kind of the main social unit that we orient our lives around. Throughout all of the Middle Ages, the church was a sovereign institution that had comprehensive powers over many different areas of human life, of culture, of social welfare. The church had its own military orders. I mean, the church was a comprehensive institution involved in everything. And the church was just one of many institutions that were like this. It was the most important one spiritually. It was the backbone of Western civilization. But there were other institutions, local institutions, and then vertically as well within society, different kinds of institutions representing different areas of life that had their own sovereignty and set apartness. And the Enlightenment tended to emphasize the centrality of the state and the dismantling of all these other institutions to concentrate their functions in the state. Rousseau said, we need to begin by exterminating these religions to secure the peace of the state. The church can't be allowed to stand as its own separate institution, because then it will act as a restraint on and an encumbrance to the state, which is in fact what it did throughout the Middle Ages, which is part of the reason there was no totalitarian power during all of medieval history. And Christians, even if they don't consciously think about it this way, have really unconsciously accepted this Enlightenment idea of the centrality of the state. And we see this when Christians treat church as a purely Sunday institution, for example. Now, you can say there are some pre-Enlightenment roots of this, but this idea that we should be suspicious if the church is involved in many different areas of human life and society, that is fundamentally an Enlightenment suspicion. And this isn't just a medieval, history versus Reformation thing either. If you look at Geneva, Calvin's consistory was very much like the medieval church in that it was a robust institution involved in many different areas of society. It is the Enlightenment that says we need to at least cabin religion to being within the private individual sphere, if not eradicate it entirely. And Christians have just acclimated ourselves subconsciously to that framing. So we should challenge it. And if we understand church history and we understand all of the ways that having a robust, comprehensive church was beneficial, then we should seek to reclaim that. And we have to start by asking ourselves, why is it that we think of church as a purely Sunday institution or activity instead of this comprehensive social institution that Christians saw it as for thousands of years, for a millennia?
Yes, that is the starting point. I think really how we could kind of wrap everything up here is just to say, there has been this just widespread assumption, absorption, acceptance of ideas that were made popular during this time, this Enlightenment period. And as you've outlined very convincingly in our little chat today, that wasn't a great exercise. Like, the Enlightenment didn't lead to these great, like, outcomes. It wasn't this, basically what I'm saying is there's many good reasons to stop and assess, is this actually a good way of thinking about things? Because those who held most closely to it, who really believed in it the most and saw it through, ended up with a worse world. So stopping to consider, especially as Christians, you know, what should we actually believe? What should we actually believe about egalitarianism? What should we believe about diversity? What should we believe about the role of the church? It should not line up this militantly secular humanist ideology.
Very well said, Carmen. I think you summed it up much better than I did.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for answering this question, Ian. We'll talk more. Obviously, this is going to come up a few different ways as we go over sort of this deep dive into culturally what's going on and what we're going to do as Christians to move forward.
Amen. Thank you, Carmen.